All right, thank you all for coming. It's good to see so many people in the audience. My presentation today is on evolving agile processes, and I guess a bit of background from where I'm coming from with that. My name's Andrew Scotland, sorry, I should introduce myself. I work for Gallagher Group down in Hamilton, or as you all know now, the birthplace of the internet. So I'm going to be today just going through sort of our experiences, really, going through various agile processes that we've experienced over the last 4 years. And so the goal of it, the goal of the session is to, you know, give you some insights or lessons that we've learnt, which will hopefully help you to make decisions or potentially change the processes or the way you're doing things. So just going to break this up into a few different sections. Actually, if I could, before I get into that, could I just have a show of hands? How many people have used Scrum? Good, that's excellent, because I'm assuming that most of you have. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time on Scrum and what we've learned from that. And then I'm going to go on to sort of a brief introduction to Kanban. So how many people have used Kanban in the audience? Yeah, maybe 20%. That's sort of what I expected. And then lastly, a bit of an introduction to learning first product development. How many people have heard of that or used that? Yeah, about two or three, which is, again, what I would have imagined. So I'm going to sort of spend a little bit of time on Scrum, a bit more time on Kanban, introduction to what it's all about and how to use it. And then lastly, give some information on learning first product development and how it's helped us and some of the things that we do with product development. Unfortunately, it's not one of my objectives to solve any process problems that you have today, but I'm more than willing to talk about any issues you might have after the session. And again, I just wanted to sort of state at the start, really, that, you know, the key goal for this session really is it's all about being pragmatic. You know, you can take a blend of processes and have a successful project or process for yourself. So just moving into that. Now, any discussion on process typically can get quite passionate. So for the sake of time for this conversation, or this presentation, I'd like to have all questions sort of held until the end. I am going to be presenting some stuff that is based on our experiences and our opinions, and it will differ from your experiences and your opinions probably, but I'm more than happy to have a robust discussion after the session. So thanks. Right. So a product development perspective, what does that mean? Well, I work for Gallagher Group, as I said before. We do a variety of products, and some of them are hardware-oriented, some of them are only software, and it's sort of a mixture of both. But the key thing is we're delivering products to go out to a set of customers that we don't always have direct contact with, which has, you know, has a set of challenges, you know, of its own. So 4 years ago, we were, I guess, you know, pretty much in a waterfall type process that we were following. And we had a few, you know, issues with that. It was predominantly projects were pretty much, you know, could take a very long time, you know, and product development in general can take 12 to 24 months easily to get a new product out to market. We also have a very high quality bar as a result of that, because we don't have, I guess most people would want that anyway, but we don't have that direct contact with our customers all the time. So we've got to make sure it's as good as it possibly can be. So what's wrong with waterfall? Well, you know, waterfall, I guess there's nothing really wrong with waterfall as long as you're not having to change direction and you know exactly what you're doing. So if you know exactly what you're going to build and you're never going to deviate from that, there's nothing wrong with the waterfall process. It's going to be perfectly suited to what it is you're trying to achieve. However, for us, what we were experiencing is projects pretty much, you know, always late, not always delivering exactly what it was that the customer wanted. We delivered what we thought the customer wanted, but it wasn't always the right thing. And as a result of that, there tended to be a lot of churn at the end of a project. So we'd think the project was done, and then we'd show it to our internal customer, and they'd go, "What?" And we'd go back and start churning around. And it, you know, obviously didn't have a good feeling. Development team wasn't happy. Customer wasn't happy. And so we thought, well, we need to do something about it. And obviously there was a lot of press around about Agile. And so we thought, well, we should give it a try. We should learn a bit more about this process, you know, which is the right one for us, which is the right version of Agile, and how are we going to implement that. So we did a bit of research, and we ended up contracting an external party to come in and help us as a company get Scrum started. So Scrum was the one that we decided we would use. It seemed like a really good fit for the type of stuff that we were going to do. So we, as I said, we got an external contractor in, and that was well worth it. If you're not doing Scrum currently, although it sounds like most of you are, and you need that assistance to get started, then it's well worth having someone who's been through the process before mentor and guide you through it. Now, I won't spend too much time on this slide based on 90% of you having been familiar with Scrum, but basically, you know, it's all about iterations, regular deliveries, and that shippable product at the end of each sprint. You know, those are the key things. Now, at the same time we implemented Scrum, we also started co-locating our teams. Now, we had we got one floor of our head office, which is our software team, and all our software developers back then, or most of them, actually had their own offices, you know, working in isolation from each other. Things got handed off. They worked in isolation. They didn't really work together as a team. So we thought, well, one of the other things we really want to do is this co-location thing. So we ripped down some office walls, which didn't make everyone happy, and we started putting people together, and we really observed a lot of improvement in the communication between those people, putting them together in those teams. It was amazing. I mean, the difference between two people sitting 5 meters apart and 2 meters apart made an enormous difference. You wouldn't think it could make that much difference, but it really did. I've certainly experienced that myself, sitting, working with a project where I'm sitting in a separate desk 5 meters away, and I thought I knew pretty much what was going on, to working on a project where I was sitting in amongst the team, and I really did know everything that was going on, and so did everyone else. And so it makes a huge difference. It can't be understated. And in fact, we've gone, this picture's a little bit old at the moment, it looks a bit cluttered there. We actually took it a step further based on the success of that, and we went and got a whole new set of desks and laid things out so that people could be could collaborate better and work closer together. So Scrum, as I said, we implemented it, and there was lots of good stuff there. You know, things were really improving for us. The prioritized product backlog, just having a clear view of what order we were going to work through things, and rather than you will do all these things, made an enormous difference. Daily stand-ups, again, it's really that communication tool, you know, that standing up once a day and knowing exactly where everyone's at, impediments quickly highlighted, all those types of things that you guys who have used Scrum will be familiar with, very beneficial. The day-to-day involvement of the product owner. So previous for us, this was, they were involved at requirements phase and then again to tell us what we'd done wrong at the end. But other than that, not too much involved. And so having them there every day to answer those little questions before they became big issues was of enormous benefit. Retrospectives. I'm not sure how much everyone else gets out of these, but for us, we actually got quite a lot of buy-in to these, and our teams used those as a really good tool to not just change the development process, but change the whole process. These things are working for us, these aren't. What are we going to do about it in the next sprint and go about actually making those changes? So, you know, very worthwhile. And the regular demos with fast feedback. So much like the involvement of the product owner, this was getting that feedback from a wider group of stakeholders for us to make sure that we really were on the right track and to help us make the right decisions about what the next thing to work on really was. And all of those things sort of combined together to help the team, you know, with the Scrum board on the wall and those daily stand-ups, really focus on tasks, and just made it a bit harder for the team members to get distracted. So lots of really good stuff in Scrum, and you know, we were pretty happy with the way things are going. However, not everything was great for us. So we had a few pain points. We had One of the bigger issues for us came from when we did all our Scrum training, as we were told, you know, ideally all your team members are cross-functional, and so if someone else can't work on a task, then anyone else in the team can pick it up. Now, with the nature of our development, we had business analysts, developers, and testers, and our testers definitely were not developers, they were specialist testers. So you already had three groups who couldn't necessarily work on each other's tasks. And even within our developers, because of the nature of some of our development is embedded development on a device, some of it's software development at the server, some of it's UI development, your UI design in a client, and all that forms part of one distributed system for our major software product that we work on. So you've got a wide range of specialties even within there. So not having people being truly cross-functional, you know, it makes it pretty difficult at sort of sprint planning time. Because effectively what that means is you're having to allocate certain tasks to certain people, and you're not just saying, well, we've got a capacity of, 20 story points for the sprint, and we've got four people with five story points each available. That didn't quite work. The other issue we had was sort of large infrastructure work. Now, a lot of these new product development also involved the development of a lot of infrastructure for features to be built on top of. And some of those infrastructure work can be, weeks, months of work before a feature can even be built. So if you've prioritized your backlog and you've got a list of stories in there, then it was, we had difficulty with stories that weren't, they're not user stories, they're infrastructure that all those stories are built on. And so we didn't plan those, I would say, particularly well. Also, and related to that, we sort of failed to prioritize by risk. So we let the product owner prioritize everything. So everything got prioritized by business value. And we weren't good enough at explaining that these things have to go together. You can't have that without this infrastructure. And what it meant is we ended up building the infrastructure in slivers rather than building the whole thing, which in turn sort of led to some loopbacks. So rather than thinking about what this infrastructure has to do and making sure it was there to support everything that we needed, we were building it a bit at a time in an iterative fashion, and that felt less efficient. And I guess this is also related, the features too big for sprints. So the pain that this caused us is, again, we had lots of features that were very large. Again, that's partly to do with the nature of the product, but also just some things are quite complicated and we weren't able to break them down into small enough chunks that could reasonably be delivered and you'd say the product was done. So without all these things being completed, it's not done, therefore we couldn't really break it down. And what that meant was that at sprint planning time, we would spend a lot of time arguing about, do we move this to another sprint? Do we split this into chunks and just say, well, it's not really done? Do we, and then if we do that, then we've got this gap here of a week. So what are we going to use to fill that week? Are we going to pick the next priority? Well, we can't do that. It's too big. And what we ended up doing in a number of cases, which never felt right, was go down to the bottom of the priority list or the bottom third. Oh, there's one that's small enough. And we brought it up to put it in there. Now, that didn't seem like the right thing to do and seemed sort of against the spirit of what we were trying to achieve by that, prioritized backlog. Right, so what did we do? Well, we decided we would adapt Scrum. And I guess this is the point where someone would be saying, that's not Scrum. And no, that's not Scrum, that's what we did. So we decided, well, we're going to do the requirements and design a sprint in advance. So that we know when we get to sprint planning, we've got this sort of clear idea about what it is we're going to do. We know how we can break down things, and we know how they can fit. We're not going to go and do all the requirements and design for everything on the backlog. We're only going to do it for the things. When we do sprint planning, we will schedule to do the design and requirements for the things that we think will be in the next sprint, just so we know enough. And then in some cases, that meant that testing fell into the sprint after. So all of a sudden, this felt better for us and was working smoother, but we were very aware of the fact that, well, hang on, that meant that sprint one, sprint two, and sprint three went by before feature one was actually done. So we're not really Scrum anymore. We're using elements of Scrum, the elements that are good for us, but we're still not done at the end of the sprint. And to be honest with you, that didn't matter so much to us, because for our product, even if we were done at the end of a sprint, there was no way we could release it to our customers. We had a cycle for releasing to customers, which was at a maximum of once every 6 months. So what was really important was that we were moving through things in that priority order. So not being done. Like I said, if not being done means if being done means releasable, then we couldn't achieve that. So, yeah, we definitely weren't using Scrum in the purest sense, but things were a lot better than they had been. You know, we had improved the process a lot. We were learning lessons, and things were generally improving. The other thing that we were doing at the same time as the Scrum work or the Scrum process changes that we're making is we started to invest a lot more heavily in test automation, and since those projects, we've invested even more heavily into it, so that we've actually got a dedicated team off to the side which is actually writing test automation for our legacy product. We've got a product that's been around for 14 years now. It's got a lot of features in it. It's, you know, it's evolving and being enhanced as it goes. But there's a lot of stuff that we need to make sure still works and that we don't break when we're working on stuff. So we invested in test automation, and we also made it a priority of each team and part of their definition of done that they would automate or create test automation for the items that they were working on. And this has worked really well for us. We've found a lot of things that we might not have found through beta test or through release to a customer. And we've also had sort of, I guess not unexpected, but nice benefits where typically we'd had required a ratio of sort of two developers to one tester for that tester to be able to keep up with the developers and not let things backlog. But once test automation was happening, and we've got an example of this in one of our teams where they've now sort of got four developers to one tester and everything's keeping up. There's no backlog developing because talking to the tester, they're saying, well, actually, part of the reason for this is I don't need to go and retest all these other things that might have been broken as a result of this feature being developed. I've got the confidence to deal with just the minimum amount that I need to test. And so that was a pretty nice fringe benefit for us. Okay. So that was sort of Scrum. And like I said, through those pain points, we had a few items that weren't working as well as we might like them. So we were sort of looking around to think, well, what, you know, is there something else that we should do? Things are a lot better than they were, don't get me wrong. But is there any way that they can be better? And so we started looking at Kanban. And for those of you who haven't heard of Kanban before, it sort of comes from the lean software movement, which came from the sort of lean manufacturing, which is something that Toyota was sort of instrumental in creating, you know, quite a long time ago, and part of what made Toyota so successful. This had a synergy for us as well, because at Gallagher's we've got a factory out the back where we make all our equipment, and they had transitioned to a lean manufacturing, and it had a massive success there in the throughput of product and how little time it took them to assemble stuff. Now, we're a bit cynical, right? Software, hardware, it's not the same thing. But, you know, we thought we should learn more about this. So I just want to do an introduction to Kanban now. Like, I'm not going to go into the real detail, but hopefully enough to give you a feel about what's different about it from Scrum and whether it might be useful for you. So as I said, it's from Kanban. There are a lot of similarities with Scrum. It's still an agile methodology. You've still got a team wall with all your tasks on it. But it's sort of more of a scheduling system. You know, it's relatively flexible with the process and how you choose to do things. So in the description up there, we've got our columns, you know, we've got our backlog, we've got analysis, development, testing, and done. And each item, which is one of your backlog items, needs to move through each of those phases before it's done. And you still put a representation of who's working on it at any particular time, and you still use things like impediments to say, this one stopped, it can't move forward. But I've got a bit of a demo of that, of a Kanban board in action in just a minute. So the basics are you create the columns to map to your process. So you can create as many or as few columns as you want. It can be as simple as just backlog in progress done, if that's all you want to manage. You pull the work when it's ready. So if I'm a developer and my primary responsibility is the development column, then if I suddenly have capacity free, I go, okay, what's ready from the previous column? Is there anything? If there is, I can pull it through. And you set these work in progress limits on the top of each column, which effectively says you're only allowed to work on this many things in this column at any one time. And the primary purpose of that is to prevent bottlenecks building up. So you just because your developers are really efficient and you don't have enough testers, you don't end up with this, let's try to prevent the scenario where I've got 30 items that have been developed and my tester hasn't been able to get through that backlog. But hopefully the demo will show a little bit clearer. And the goal of Kanban is really to manage throughput, not to achieve 100% utilization of each person in the team. So the goal is for things to move from backlog to done as quickly as possible, not for every person to be 100% busy on specific tasks. And they might sound like the same thing, but they're not. So it's all about sort of reducing that cycle time, so making things move from transition to transition as quickly as possible. And by doing that, you can eliminate waste, which is where the lean manufacturing sort of philosophy comes from. So if you think about it, if something is being developed and then it sits waiting ready for test for 3 weeks before it gets into testing, and meanwhile developers start to work on something else, when the tester does get to it and they have questions and they want to ask the developer about it, developer's going, that's right, I did this, or maybe I didn't, or hang on, I'll just have to go back and check. That's all waste. If you can move things through smoothly, you don't have those inefficiencies within the system. And that's what the throughput or reducing the cycle time is all about. So, demo. So we've got a Kanban board up here. I've made it pretty simple. I've created some quite low work in progress limits just to illustrate a point. So in this case here, every column is full. So development has got two items in progress and two items that are done. Testing has got two items that are in progress. So the first thing that happens here is feature two is completed testing, so it's moved to done. What that's done is created capacity in the testing column. So testing column, now the testers now have capacity to pull something through. So they go, okay, right, I'll grab feature three and I'll start testing that. What that's done is create capacity in the development column. So developers has three things available. So, okay, well, there's an item that's finished analysis. We can grab that and we'll pull that through and we'll start working on it. That in turn has created capacity in the analysis column. So the business analyst can now pull an item through and start work on it. Now, the fundamental philosophy here is you need to be strict about this stuff. You can, as a team, decide to increase your work in progress limits if you feel they're artificially constraining your team. But most of the time, you're trying to stick to those and don't start work on something that's just going to create a backlog somewhere else. So just to illustrate that point, so if I'm in this case, in this example here, so it's the same starting point, but what happens now is the developer finishes work on feature five, and that moves to done. That developer, at the moment, can't do anything else in the development column. Just because there's only one item in progress, they can't start work on another development item. If they do, all they're going to do is create a backlog, which is going to increase the cycle time and reduce the overall efficiency of items moving through. They've got a couple of choices. They can either help out in testing or business analysis, if that's a skill that they have, and thus help things move through quickly. Or maybe they go, right, well, I've been meaning to learn about this thing for some time, or there's those comments I've been meaning to update in the code. I'll go and do those things. They don't have an impact on this project. So there might be things they can do to either upskill themselves or get improve documentation or things that aren't going to create load on the project that they can do in this time. So like I said, it's not about 100% utilization. It's about making sure things flow through as smoothly as possible. And I've got an example later of how we've added some other columns, which you'll see, which, as I said before, we've got automated testing in there, which our developers can go and do that, and that's working quite nicely. So enforcing process with Kanban. So really it's as simple as adding columns. Now each item is supposed to move through the columns that you put on the board. So really it's up to you. What do you want? How do you want things to move through? In this example up here, you know, I've added a design column. I don't want anything to move from analysis to development without going through design. And I don't want things to build up there. Within development, I want everything to go through a code review. I want to make sure that everyone has done one of those. So I'm going to add that sort of sub-column, but that overall work in progress limit still applies. And then lastly, I've added automation. So I'm going to say that it's not done unless it's been automated. So it's all very well that it's been manually tested, but if it hasn't been automated, it's not done, and we can't move it through. So just a quick example. It's probably, you know, I honestly, obviously can't read any of this stuff in here, but I guess what I was trying to point out here is, this is an example of one of our boards at work, is that I think you can sort of see clearly where the problem is for this team and what they need to focus on. There's one column, which looks like it's got a lot more than six. They're sort of actually tasks. They're all grouped together to make one big task, so it's not as bad as it looks. But it's still very clear at a glance that this team needs to get onto this ready-to-automate column, which you won't be able to read it, but that's that column that's too large. And they should be doing that before they start pulling new development tasks through. So something that I observed here is that actually the teams that implemented this became much more self-managing really, really quick. All of a sudden, it became really obvious what decision to make, you know, what to do next. So, you know, that was amazing. And I got those comments back from the team members themselves as well, that you know, yep, it was really good. And actually, the team that this came from, since then, and their last retrospective, all the comments were about how smooth everything felt now, how things were moving through quite quickly, and they felt like they were operating much better. And this is a team that had actually been using Scrum for a couple of years before that, and doing well at that as well. So, like I said, it's not actually a major shift, although there is sort of a fundamental difference in the way, in the goals you're trying to achieve. One lesson that I would like to sort of point out for this, especially if you're just starting this sort of Kanban process, definitely, you know, at least at the beginning, you want to stick to sort of whiteboards and paper. You know, you'll be rubbing out columns, adding new columns, changing what's on the your sticky notes, that sort of stuff. Now, I've certainly got no problem, and it looks like the TFS 2012 and the team web experience has gotten a lot better. So it looks like things are, you know, really improving in that area. But still, when you're getting started and you're working out which is the process or exactly what the process is that's right for you, it's not a bad idea to, you know, keep it in something that's going to be very easy for you to, you know, tweak and play with. Just quickly also on Kanban, some metrics that are useful. So one of the things about Kanban is there's sort of no real requirement. I mean, you can if you want, but there's no real requirement to record number of hours remaining on a task, which is again quite different to Scrum. What we do capture is the cycle time. So how long? So when a task moves from the backlog into analysis, we record the time it starts, and we record the time it finishes when it moves to done. And so all we're doing is looking at the average cycle time for tasks. On average, how long does it take a task once it starts to finish? That's the goal. The thing is all about reducing cycle time, because if we reduce cycle time, we're reducing waste. Now, so that's quite useful just to see how things are trending. The other one, the cumulative flow, is really your forecasting tool. So it's saying that, okay, again, this is probably quite hard to read, especially if you guys in the back, that, say, week 9, we'd had 15 items had moved to done in the project. You know, week 12... we had 18, 19 items moved to done. And so what you get is this line. So at each period, you record how many items have got to done, and you get this line which is sort of forecasting. Well, basically, on average, if I track that out, I can see that at week 30, I should have this many items and done, you know, if it averages out. And you can do, extra things like that if it's not working by breaking them up into like shirt size type things. So my cycle time for a small task is this on average. My cycle time for a medium task is this, to give you those sort of estimation tools. So it's really just about giving you that rough forecast of how long it's going to take to get to a certain point through the backlog, and also how efficient are we? Are we getting better? Are we getting worse? So just sort of in summary for Kanban then, one big thing for us was no sprint planning. So we weren't having to have these arguments about what to fit where. We were pulling things through as they were ready to be worked on. And the first thing they moved through was the design phase, so we do the task breakdown effectively there. And we were in some cases allowing, you know, we do the task breakdown in the design phase. If it turned out that item was much, much bigger than what we'd thought about and when we did the backlog estimate, we still had the option of canning it before we actually pulled it through to development. Process enforced, again, that very visible sort of view of what columns there are and where everything is at within that process. And it's sort of like a whole project view rather than within Scrum, you've sort of got that, you know, sprint view. And the highlighting of bottlenecks, you know, the WIP limits to prevent multitasking. So those two things are, you know, very, very valuable. Oh, yep, that project's about to get blocked right here. We should probably do something about it. And just helps all the team members to see that and to, you know, raise it themselves. So really those resources, I guess, you know, the slides will obviously be available after this, but there's a couple of books, the Henrik Nyberg, hopefully I pronounced that right, has written some very good stuff on this. So he wrote a book, Scrum XP from the Trenches, which is a really good overview of how to use Scrum, and he's followed that up with Lean from the Trenches, which is all about Kanban, how to implement Kanban on a large scale. And very, it's quite a short book, you know, it's not no more than 100 pages, maybe only 80, so very easy to read. And gives you a good overview of, you know, of what the benefits are. And the last one there, the Get Kanban board game. Now, this is for those of you who've got a reasonable budget. This is one of the most expensive board games I've ever seen. But it was also very, very useful. Those screenshots I had from the metrics, they came from the game. It's basically a game that you can play with a team if it's thinking about doing Kanban. And it teaches them Kanban through the game and shows you how it helps and shows you where the gotchas are and the types of things that you want to record. So not cheap, but very, very useful. And in fact, quite enlightening for us. We ended up, surprisingly, considering how much it is. I can't bear myself to say how much it was. come and see me afterwards. But we actually ended up buying a second one just so that we could have two teams play it at the same time. And the amazing thing with that was the teams made different decisions along the way as items came in. Actually, to summarise, one of them chased the short-term money, and one of them focused on reducing cycle time. And guess which one won? You know, the one that's focused on cycle time ended up, you know, delivering a lot more stuff and producing a lot more business value. So, you know, very, very useful tool to quickly get an understanding of it if you're interested. Okay. Yeah, so Kanban, great. But that doesn't mean you have to give up all the stuff from Scrum, right? You know, Scrum was really good. We were a lot better after Scrum. So, you know, we're still doing this sort of regular cadence of demos and retrospectives. Every 3 weeks, we demo everything that moved to done in the last 3 weeks. And we have a retrospective afterwards to say, so how did the last 3 weeks go? You know, is there anything we can improve? There's nothing to stop us doing that. We still do the daily stand-ups. We still have the product owner heavily involved, and we still do backlog planning. So we're still doing all those things that were valuable in Scrum. There was no need to give them up just because we'd moved to a slightly different process. And the pros, as I've sort of mentioned already, is that, you know, better visibility of the overall project status and identification of bottlenecks, no sprint planning, and that focusing on efficiency. And the other thing I just wanted to mention there briefly, I said we were sort of mostly always late. Well, I guess, unfortunately, our projects are still mostly always late. However, they could easily be on time. It's really all about our business unit, which says when to release, deciding, you know, we've got something that could be released at the time that we said, but the minimum set of features always seems to grow. Okay, so Kanban's improved our process. Maybe there's something else that we can learn from Toyota, and that's sort of my lead-in, really, to this learning first product development. Now, learning first product development, as I just sort of alluded to, again comes from the sort of Toyota background. It was their process for how they did product development, for how they decided what the right products to do and how they could guarantee the success of those products. Now, we were sort of introduced to this about a couple of years ago by the Better by Design initiative of New Zealand Trade and Enterprise. And there are a couple other companies that have been working with this. I think Fisher & Paykel and Tate Electronics are a couple of those. And so we've been working with it, like I said, for probably about, well, maybe 18 months now. We sort of started mostly focusing on our hardware side because within our R&D department, we've got about 110 people in the R&D department, and just over half of those are software, but we've also got lots of electronics, you know, mechanical engineers as well. And we've also got people who are responsible for getting things through to the factory. And so we sort of focused on the hardware side to begin with, but we could see it was starting to have benefits there, and the whole department went through the training, and we could see that there was definitely some of the stuff in there that would, you know, would help us. Excuse me. So one of the best ways that I've found or I've seen to date to sort of give you an overview of how this, what Learning First product development is all about, is this example of the Wright brothers, which is obviously something that, you know, pretty much everyone knows about. Whether you agree they were the first to fly, that's, you know, maybe questionable, but they're certainly pretty impressive what they achieved. So, Wright brothers. So, what did they do? Well, obviously, they had this objective. They wanted to achieve, you know, heavier than air powered manned flight. And this, obviously, it's over 100 years ago. These guys, not necessarily your normal candidates who you'd expect to be achieving this. They're high school dropouts, and they owned a bicycle repair shop. So, perhaps not the credentials you would have expected. So what did they do about it? Well, once they decided this is something that they wanted to achieve, the first thing they did was research all the body of existing knowledge from everyone who'd tried to do stuff in the past. So they did all the research they could, and they found who the experts were, and they corresponded with them. As a result of that, what they identified actually was the sort of three main reasons why people had failed before. So construction of wings, you know, the application of the power and propulsion and the balancing and steering in flight. If they could master these things, there was a good chance they'd be able to achieve something. And they also found that everyone else had basically spent, you know, 5,000 hours developing something before testing it for the first time, where it flew for not long at all before crashing. So they decided, well, they needed to do something a little bit different in the way they were going to approach this. So they started doing it by sort of testing or experimentation first. And as part of that, they conducted thousands of tests. So they weren't testing the whole product, they were testing the individual bits of it that people didn't know enough about, or were the reasons that people had failed in the past. So they had things like, you know, prototypes effectively, you know, models that they could launch to see whether the wing shapes would work. They actually invented the first wind tunnel so that they could do those types of tests. Remember these guys, bicycle repair shop owners, not too shabby. And the other thing that they did, which was really important is from the learning first point of view, is that as well as experimenting and carrying out all these tests on the areas they didn't know enough about, they recorded all those results so that they could refer back to them and know why they'd made certain decisions and remember, oh, okay, that's not going to work with this because. And so, in the period of sort of 3 years, you know, they devised a lot of pretty amazing stuff, considering that there'd been plenty of people investing a lot of money in this previously. They devised the lift and drag measurements. They devised the wind tunnel. You know, they discovered that marine propellers didn't work. Now, that was a pretty big discovery, that you couldn't just use a marine propeller to achieve manned flight. And they invented a whole heap of little components that they needed to make this flight work. And so once they were success assured, once they'd decided they'd solved all the problems that had made people fail in the past, then they put it all together. And the very first time they went out to fly this plane, they flew it 4 times successfully on that first day, which is, you know, again, like I said, it's a pretty impressive achievement. And so to put that into perspective, comparison with their major competitor at the time, they did it in, you know, 22 months versus 17 years. They spent $1,000 versus 70. And the approach is sort of fundamentally different. So the competitors design, build, test, repeat, which I'm sure a few people will find familiar as a methodology. They did sort of test and experiment to begin with. And they repeated that until they were sure of it. Then they designed and built. So again, sounds like sort of, you know, a bit of common sense, but it's, you know, their first design was successful and the competitor's airplane never flew. That's pretty compelling. So yeah, in conclusion, they learned what they needed to be successful before they implemented the solution. So common sense, you might say, not something you see all the time. Okay, so that's sort of just a little bit about, you know, an example of how that's worked. And I just want to go quickly. I'm not going to go into every single LFPD tool and process that there is. I just want to go into the ones that the topmost ones that we've seen as useful for software. If it's something you're interested about, you know, you can find out more at a later stage. So LFPD process and tools. So the key philosophy here behind Lambda, behind LFPD is Lambda. So that starts with look. So the first thing you're supposed to be doing is looking around, understanding what is the body of knowledge, you know, understanding what is the problem that I've got now here, what am I trying to solve? And only once you really understand that do you go to the next step, which is ask, which is now, I think I understand, I need to start asking the people around me, asking the right questions, asking the experts, asking the customers, you know, just confirming that what I saw is what we're trying to achieve here. Then having done that, we want to model it. We want to say, okay, here's the model of what I understand the problem to be so that we can make sure that everyone is on the same page. Are we all thinking about the same thing when we discuss this problem or this opportunity? Then we want to discuss. So now we've got that model that everyone can review, we want to review it with everyone who's a stakeholder in this project or in this product to make sure, again, that we've got that right understanding. And once we've discussed it, we want to act. And now act might be to implement it if we're sure of it, but act might also be to start the process again for one subpart of that because it turns out we don't understand enough about this particular area. So yeah, so that's sort of the key philosophy, and it's all about getting to that success assured state before you start the actual investment and development. Okay, so again, like I said, just a few tools that I've sort of uncovered as part of this process that you may find useful. One of the key tools for LFPD, and this is one of the key things that Toyota made a lot of use of, is something called an A3. Now, an A3, unsurprisingly, is an A3-sized piece of paper. But it's really a tool for decision-making. So the goal here is to put all the information about a particular problem or opportunity or customer interest on one piece of page, summarized in such a way that everyone can read it quickly, everyone can see that the right thought process has been gone through, and that we can sort of prove that we have considered all the options that we should consider. Now, I've just got an example of that on my next slide. Now, I realize you probably won't be able to read the content of that, but I guess what's important is the key sections. So we start with the description. And in this case here, this A3 was actually, we were looking at Active Directory integration for our security product, and we were looking at what are the different options we could do for that Active Directory integration. So the description is just sort of saying, okay, what it is that we're trying to achieve, what is it that customers are wanting out of this. And then we have an analysis section. And so in the analysis section, we're looking at, okay, what are all the different options that are available to us for these integration, and potentially what are the pros and cons of those. Again, this is all summarized so that it's just enough information to make decisions. And so we've got a graph there of the performance of the four different integrations. So much like the Wright brothers in their experimentation, we wanted to do a few quick prototypes so that we could understand enough about each of those to work out whether there are any major issues or major unknowns for us if we were to proceed with this integration. And so we identified four different ones. We created this alternatives matrix for the four options we identified, put the pros and cons in there. Each of those was actually linked to what we call a test day three, which was the results of the test of that individual technology investigation. And then we've got a set of recommendations and links to other related resources. And then we've got next steps, which is, okay, this is effectively recording what it is we're going to do next for this problem. Because these A3s are a living document, living live document to help you work through the process of solving a problem or, you know, developing a proposal or, you know, even a business case. And as you see here, we've got no results. And so this was a classic example of where this was really useful to have done this and documented it. We could put this one piece of paper in front of our developer or a tester or someone from our business unit. Anyone could read this and consume it and understand where we'd got to and why, which is a pretty valuable thing. And we've got no results because actually that project, we got to this point where we'd done this, we'd worked out what it was, we'd worked out we had a couple of options that we could choose and we'd be pretty much guaranteed to be successful if we did this integration. But another priority came along, so we parked it. Now the good thing about this is, and I experienced this just last week actually, as I got a request from one of our business development managers that said, we must have an Active Directory integration for one of our customers. You know, can you tell me how much that might cost, or do you know how we could do that? I was able to go into our document library, pull out this, oh yeah, okay, that's right, we had this, drill into the particular one that was an option, find out about it, and an hour later, give some information about, okay, you could offer this, but you'd have to give, you know, these are the constraints. You know, and so it really is about having that knowledge documented, easy to find, easy to consume, and trustworthy, you know. So, yeah, very worthwhile. The next one I just wanted to go over was a decision tree. And so this one here is really, again, it's about getting to that success assured state. So this is about documenting all the decisions you need to make in a project and putting dependencies between those decisions. Now, they're not necessarily all specifically design decisions. Some of them will be like, you know, requirement decisions. And so in this example here, for a mobile client, I'm trying to say, okay, this is what we need to do to build a mobile client for our system. First of all, we need to, do we need access to a GPS? Do we need access to the camera? Do we need access to the accelerometer? I need to make all these decisions before I can decide on what platform I'm going to target. And then once I've made that decision, I need to decide, you know, is it going to be native? Is it going to be web? Is it going to be hybrid? You know, what type of client? And only once I've made those decisions will I make, you know, these other decisions about authentication, you know, what language and frameworks to use, whether I should use SOAP versus REST for web services. And then once I've made all those decisions, that's when I've said, okay, I'll be success assured then. So what that means is I don't need to spend any time on UI storyboard or UI styling at the start of this project. I should leave that as late as possible in the project, because the later I leave a decision, the better the decision is going to be, because I'll have more information and more knowledge at that point. So this is really about helping you to work out what should I focus on first. I need to make that decision first. And what are all the dependencies on those things? Now, if you're looking at that diagram and you're going, well, that's wrong, those dependencies aren't right, well, again, it's achieving its purpose, because it's making everyone think about what are the things that we need to focus on. So it's, again, it's a tool for getting everyone on the same page as well. Okay, and the last tool I just wanted to go through quickly, just conscious of the time, is customer interest decision matrix. So this one here, again, is about working out what are all my key knowledge gaps that I need to close before I can be sure I know what to do for this project. So in this case here, I've got two main categories. I've got usability and performance. Under usability, I've got a subcategory or a customer interest decision of learnability. And how am I going to measure that? Well, I'm going to measure it by the number of mistakes made when I take people through my prototypes or through my storyboards. And I've got two targets. I've got my target for success assured, which is no more than three mistakes that the user makes when they go through it. But really what I'd like is one. That'd be my target for optimization. But if I could achieve three, I'd be willing to start the process. And then similarly for, you know, clicks to perform an action and performance page load time, you've got to work out the unit of measure. What is the target that would be acceptable that you can guarantee? How are you going to prove it? And what's your target for optimization? And then the colors there effectively indicate what state those decisions are in. So if it's green, it's, yep, we're confident we've met success assured for that. We know we can prove it. So the green one was mapping of UI workflows. We can do that easily. We know, we've done that, and it's worked. For yellow, for the usability, for the learnability, we're pretty confident, but we're not 100% sure that we can achieve that one. And red, performance, it's red because we just don't know. We haven't closed that knowledge gap. We don't know if we can achieve that. We haven't chosen a platform yet. We don't know what our performance is going to be like. So probably shouldn't start the project until we can turn that one at least yellow, preferably green. So the idea is you get you have this list on your wall, on your team wall, with all the key customer interest decisions that you need to make, and you want to turn them all green before you start the project. Okay. Just quickly then through the actual process itself. Now, I realize you probably need a telescope to read that one. But the key thing to point out here is that sort of orange on this predictor arrow that's going up the side, that's where we're doing our learning first. So we're going through these stages of opportunity, concept, solution, optimization, and only once success is assured do we branch off and start development. But the key is that we keep developing that knowledge that we need to make decisions. And so we keep learning that. So as we go through those stages, we learn more and we make a decision, do we want to move to the next stage or not? And as I said, construction does not start until success is assured. So I'm going to go into some more detail about this one here. Don't worry about the detail. Definitely won't be able to read this one. But the key thing is we've got these sort of three main stages that those phases are in. We've got discover, design, and deliver. And so our discover is really almost more like the business case phase of things. We're just trying to work it out, what is it that we want to do before we go into the design phase where we're maybe working out the high-level architecture of the thing and closing all those knowledge gaps before we go into deliver, which is really not until deliver that you're really doing, you know, the actual production coding. Okay. So, discover phase. Starts with the opportunity phase. We do our initial customer interests, which are sort of like, you know, your high-level requirements for what is it the customer wants to get out of this product. We create proposal A3. This is what we're going to achieve. And then we do an estimate for the concept phase. We say, right, so we've identified this, and to complete the concept phase, it's going to take this much effort. Then we have a meeting with the stakeholders of the business and say, do you want us to do the next stage or not? Yep, okay, they're willing to invest in that. So we start the concept phase. And in the concept phase, we're trying to, okay, what are all our knowledge gaps? What are all the things that we don't know enough about to be sure that we could succeed with this project? What are all the systems? What are all the possible alternatives? And once we know all that, then we can estimate, well, we think it'll take this long for the solution phase, where we're going to close those knowledge gaps, maybe create a thin end-to-end architectural slice, you know, prototype some solutions for those different knowledge gaps that we identified. And then we estimate the solution phase, and again, we can make that decision. Do you really want to, proceed with that or not? Assuming the answer is yes, then we're in the solution phase, which is all about closing those knowledge gaps, creating prototypes, proving that we've got a solution that will actually work. So if you give us the go-ahead to implement the solution, we are confident we can do it and it'll be successful. And we also identify those sort of optimization opportunities. So while we know we can achieve success assured, but we think it probably could be even better in these areas, but we'd need to spend more time on that if you wanted us to. And so then the optimization phase becomes optional. You know, if you were willing to let us, if you're willing to let us invest a little extra time, we can look for ways to make this product even better. And so then we go into deliver phase, which is really just your traditional software development. So, you know, your construction, you know, your design, your coding, your testing, and then validation, you know, a regression test, beta test, all those types of things which, you know, we commonly use. Now, you're probably looking at all that and thinking, that's pretty heavyweight. I don't, not sure I'd want to be doing all that. But really is sort of as heavyweight as you want to make it. Like, just because there's a lot of things there, closing knowledge gaps, blah, blah, blah. Some one of those stages might take half a day, you know, if the project's small enough. It doesn't need to take, you know, a lot of time. It's really just about going through that process and making sure you have closed those knowledge gaps before you proceed to the next level. So, trying to bring it all together there, Scrum, Kanban, and LFPD. So we can use Scrum and Kanban techniques. Obviously, we can use them for the delivery and task scheduling aspects of the project. So we can definitely do that in construction. But you can use that in any phase. It's really just a means of scheduling tasks, you know, moving work through. You can use that in any of those LFPD phases that you want to. And so the key thing about that, and using the LFPD tools, you know, so you can identify knowledge gaps, you know, A3s, even if you don't do anything else with LFPD, I'd highly recommend at least looking into A3s. It's a great technique. And, you know, evaluating possible solutions, so not leaping to the first solution that will work, but looking at what are the different types and which ones are better than others and why. And that last point there, you know, ensuring that the project moves through those phases, that's sort of our way of making sure that we don't leap to the first solution and put something out that, while it works, might not be the thing that's going to really delight our customers or work well into the future. You know, and as a product development company, it's really important to us that we do, you know, delight our customers, give them what they want, and what's more, give them something that's going to last with them for many years. So, key takeaways from my presentation. As I said at the beginning, be pragmatic. There really is nothing wrong, well, not from my point of view anyway, with a process mashup. Taking the best bits from the different processes you've used, tweaking them to work for you, and getting that process, you know, fine-tuned so you've got a happy, productive team. Be agile with the process, not just the development. So again, that sort of relates to that first point. It's that you don't have to stick to something just because that's the definition in the book. You can, you know, turn it around to work for you. Kanban can be a good alternative. It doesn't mean you need to. I should have pointed this out earlier. We still do have teams that, you know, using bits of, or using Scrum, and we're doing it very successfully. And our teams, which didn't have a lot of infrastructure work and had very well-defined tasks building on top of a well-established infrastructure, still worked pretty well in Scrum. But more and more of our teams, and we offer them the choice, more and more of our teams are moving to Kanban. Now, yeah, LFPD is a process that you can use, you know, on top of any other, you know, delivery process that you're already using. Yeah, and you don't have to adopt the entire process, but there are elements of it that definitely can be of help to you. And lastly, you know, try not to commit to a solution until you have identified and closed all those knowledge gaps. That's sort of the main lesson out of Learning First from my point of view. Right, so I had a slide here on related resources, but all it ended up including was one that's already been done. So that's not too helpful. If you want to contact me, you can contact me on that on my email address or on Twitter, or I'm also more than happy to hang around after the presentation, or there might be time to take a few questions before the end. Okay, and lastly, thank you all for coming along, and don't forget to do all your evaluations to be in for a chance to win. Okay, thank you very much.